$1,000 with just a few moments of effort. After several conversations, the builder agreed to a fee of 10% instead of 15%. Saved my client about $70,000. Mr. Gifford did not charge his client, the neurosurgeon, a fee for his negotiating efforts. This is what he told me. He is a client. He pays for our accounting and tax planning. Everything else is free. It's just part of our service. But I tell them, send me some business. Tell your friends about us. Referrals. That is how we do business. This is one of the reasons for the growth of Mr. Gifford's accounting practice, but there is more. Eventually, the builder in this case became a Gifford client, because Mr. Gifford referred several of his other wealthy clients to the builder. He did an excellent job constructing homes for both the neurosurgeon and several of Mr. Gifford's clients. In essence, Mr. Gifford knows how to win friends and clients and make them all happy, but he will never try to gouge a supplier or cut a builder's profit to the bone. But you never want to cut a deal so one-sided that the supplier, a builder or whoever, resents you. They want a fair deal. And remember, if you cut them to the bone, they will likely ignore your request to come back and repair things after the home is completed. It's just the same about auto dealers. Sure, I can cut deals so that they sell cars at cost, even below. But they will hate me and my clients. Just try and go back under these circumstances and see what kind of warranty work they will do. Or ask for a free loaner car. You cut them to the bone and you can just about forget service after the sale. On the other hand, you can't sit by and let your own clients get ripped off. Nobody should have to pay 15% to build a home, or the list price of any automobile. Be fair and be balanced, and everyone will win in the long run. If I were contemplating the construction of an expensive home, I would have my attorney cut the deal with my builder. I am far too inexperienced to go up against a builder who has negotiated more than 100 construction deals. I would also add my accountant to the team. I would ask him to iron out the mathematical details of the contract with the builder. Why bring in all these third parties? Because in the long run you can save many dollars. Even if your CPA and attorney charge you several hundred dollars per hour for their input, and you have to pay $5,000 or even $10,000, skilled professionals can save you 5, 10, even 20 times their fees by cutting a reasonable deal for their clients. There is something else involved in this equation. Builders and other suppliers tend to perform better when they realize that a customer is well represented by enlightened professionals. Some of these suppliers have a name for such a customer. He's a businessman. People in business tend to have more respect for businessmen and businesswomen than for Mr. and Mrs. are likely naive consumer. So be businesslike when contemplating major expenditures like home construction. 6. Always understand the meaning of an easily affordable home. Have you ever once in your life purchased a home that was easy to afford? If your answer is yes, you may be wealthy or on your way to becoming wealthy. But often, millionaires have, at some time in their lives, purchased homes that were not easy to afford. In fact, about 4 in 10 millionaires, 42%, have done so. How is it possible that someone can buy a home on which it's difficult to make mortgage payments, yet they become wealthy? The key is not only the purchase price of an expensive home. A major factor is whether or not the home will appreciate in value. Another consideration is whether or not the purchaser's income will significantly rise in real dollar terms. Keep some things in mind when you consider purchasing a home that may be a bit out of your league. Would the proposed mortgage payments be difficult to make? What about tomorrow? Will your income rise or fall? Will the value of the proposed home increase substantially in the near future? Answer these and related questions honestly, and you are less likely to make a major financial mistake. What if you are not candid even with yourself, and you convince yourself there is nothing wrong with buying a $1.2 million home with just 10% of your own money as a down payment? But after you make your mortgage payments each month and cover household operating costs, you will have $0 left over. The luxury home-buying cowboys convince themselves this is only a temporary problem. They tell me, my income will continue to rise each year. The value of the home will explode over the next few years. I'm a seasoned investor, That's why I'm not risking much of my own money, just 10%. It's a leverage deal. With just $120,000 of my own money, I control nearly $1.1 million of the banks. The value of that home will double in 5 years. I can just feel it. So for an investment of only $120,000, I will soon own a $2.4 million home. After I pay back the mortgage, I'll walk away with over $1 million profit. My response to such logic is to give these cowboys the names and addresses of the top bankruptcy lawyers in the country. In sharp contrast to cowboys, most millionaires were already wealthy before they purchased their current homes in their mid-40s to early 50s. When people ask me about the meaning of affordable, I have a simple answer. Before you purchase your next dream home, assume that within a year of your purchase, your total annual realized income is cut in half. How long would you be able to make mortgage and related payments given your reduced income? Go the next step and assume that your investments also decline in value by 50%. Could you still make ends meet for at least 5 years? If the answer is no, then the home you wish to purchase is not easily affordable. It's difficult to tell a pro forma cowboy that bad times follow good times. Most of them have never had to earn an income during bad times. They think that because the economy is booming, it will go on indefinitely. It will not. But try telling that to a young stockbroker who earned $300,000 in commissions last year. These sales professionals are the very ones who overpay for homes and overextend themselves in good times. They judge their ability to pay for expensive homes and lead an opulent lifestyle on their single best income year. It's no wonder that many seasoned and productive sales professionals actually have mixed feelings about so-called good economic times. They enjoy participating in a prosperous economy, but they can produce even in bad times. They like bad times because the cowboys, especially the young ones, get eliminated, and seasoned veterans have fewer competitors. The same applies to home buyers. The smart ones realize that low interest rates and the rapid growth of high-income households translate into significant increases in the purchase price of homes. The price of expensive homes today is a direct function of the number of high-income producing cowboys. The greatest number of cowboys were born in 1957. So today, these early 40-something home buyers seem to be everywhere that million-dollar homes and mortgages exist in high concentrations. Watch what happens to many cowboys during the next downturn. There will be many trophy homes available. Green or blue? Why does Mr. Green have a significantly higher net worth than others in his income bracket? He will tell you that he is an extremely productive investor. He's wealthy today because he has a fully integrated process of allocating his investment dollars, and he doesn't limit his investments to the stock market. Mr. Green recognizes that there are many other great opportunities. He does indicate that investing in the equities of public corporations has helped him become rich. But there are other factors that are significant in his investing habits. He has a hunter's nose. He can look around at his environment and hunt out or recognize good investment opportunities. Or, as Mr. Green responded on the questionnaire he completed, seeing business opportunities others did not see. Mr. Green has considerable knowledge of the real estate market trends in his area. He wrote to me, "The Millionaire Next Door is a significant publication. My wife and I loved it, discussed it with friends and family, and still compare ourselves to the norms. Where we differ is in making real estate a major investment opportunity. We are not wed to our house, but enjoy it. We'll sell it in the next year or two and expect a profit of $2.1 million, or 125% before taxes. We'll build another, smaller house, pay off our relatively small 11% mortgage, pay the taxes, and still be up $1 million. Welcome to Greenwich, Connecticut in the 90s. The Greens built their current home 6 years ago at a cost of $1.7 million, including the land. What is it worth 5 years later? According to Mr. Green, $3.8 million is the actual value. According to my own research, this figure is a very conservative estimate. The property could bring more than $4 million. The Greens are charter members of the Balance Sheet Affluent Group. If you follow Mr. Green's actions regarding the purchase of real estate, your balance sheet may be enhanced. The Greens have bought and sold homes 4 times in 10 years, and they learn something each time. Today they buy something they feel will be relatively easy to sell at a good profit someday. They know that the more homework and negotiating they do as buyers, the better they will do one day as the seller of the same property. Contrast their methods with the Blues, charter members of the Income Statement Affluent Club. They have a net worth about twice their annual realized income and could have a difficult time living on it for more than a few years. The Blues are on a consumption treadmill. They earn to spend, spend to earn. They purchased their $2.5 million dream home with a multi-million dollar mortgage. Mr. Green and Mr. Blue reported the actions they have taken in the process of purchasing a home, including planning and deliberating, searching and negotiating. During their adult lifetimes, both have purchased existing homes, but most recently both decided to have homes built for them. Mr. Blue purchases homes he cannot easily afford, and he avoids testing a seller's price sensitivity. Like most members of the IA group, he is impatient. He believes in the buy now, pay later philosophy. Today, IAs feel euphoric because of sudden upswings in their income. So why wait until they become wealthy in terms of balance sheet pro formas? They spend in anticipation of becoming rich tomorrow, and in their minds they are already economic successes based on their income statements. Mr. Blue was assured that he could pay for his $2.5 million home. After all, his private banker approved his jumbo mortgage. Mr. Blue counted the income dollars he expects to earn over the next 10 years and forecasted the contributions that each of his clients will make in fees and commissions to his mortgage fund. This top-producing, extraordinary salesman has it all figured into his purchasing equation. Mr. Blue looks at credit as a weapon to enhance his balance sheet, so he believes in using other people's money through mortgage loans. He assumes that his $2.5 million home will significantly appreciate even in the short run. Like most IA types, he firmly believes that he got a real deal on his home. But Mr. Blue is in for a surprise. Who really gets most of the real deals in residential real estate? It's not the Blues, the IAs, it's the Greens, the BAs. Once he decided to build a home, Mr. Blue wanted to cut the deal immediately. The experienced building contractor sensed that Mr. Blue is a dog in heat, and that the dog has to have the home right away. By definition, he is insensitive to price and costs, but very sensitive to the size, facade, style, jacuzzi, and other expensive features. Mr. Green would never pay $2.5 million for the home that Mr. Blue currently occupies. He is far too experienced to pay full retail, and he is extremely patient. Builders can also sense this trait. Mr. Green demanded and convinced the builder to work near cost. He did his homework, made some reasonably good estimates, and boldly asked the builder for the actual cost data from homes he recently built. Mr. Blue is in a rush, and he has no idea what it actually cost to build his home. There is another element present. Mr. Blue wants to express himself. He feels a compulsion to reflect his inner being with a totally unique home and home-building experience. His need for self-expression can be satisfied, but at a high cost. Mr. Blue's dream home is so unique that not one builder could even come up with a recent cost analogy. This being the case, how can a builder be expected to give a firm cost figure? With no firm cost figures, you cannot negotiate to or near a builder's cost. Some builders work only under the conditions of cost plus. It is Mr. Blue's builder's cost, the a priori great unknown, plus, say, a 20% add-on as his fee. What happens when you force a builder to construct a home that is so unique, so custom-oriented, so architecturally self-actualizing, that every day is a new learning experience for him? And every day his meter is running? You are paying big dollars to move him along the learning curve. If your home eventually costs considerably more to build than a traditional one, prospective buyers don't care when you have to sell it. They aren't interested that you were self-actualizing during the design and building phases. They are insensitive to your builder's problem with starting at ground zero on the learning curve. Mr. Green has consistently been able to cut a much better deal, in part because he has much more experience with builders and residential real estate in his area. He insisted that the real estate agent reduce her commission so the seller of the property could reduce the price even more. As an astute negotiator, he believes in the power of competition among all the actors in this play. He is much more patient than Mr. Blue. He is not the dog in heat. The builder, the real estate agent, and the seller of the property figured this out, because he actually made it easy for them to understand his motives and home buying needs. I never ever try to purchase a home or lot within a short span of time. I'm always looking for a great opportunity. I can inventory a building lot for years before I decide to build a home on it. I take weeks, months, even a year or more to shop around for the very best deal overall. I'm never in a hurry. I'm always searching for a bargain home or lot that may be part of a foreclosure, divorce settlement, or estate sale. Mr. Builder, if you're willing to work with me on a price, I'll work around your schedule. When you have some slack time, perhaps you might be interested in building for me. I'm an unusual customer. I buy residential real estate not only as a place to live, but as an investment. I always buy with the idea of having to sell someday. Reduce your commission on the sale, and I'm sure the seller of the property would also offer an additional discount. People look to me as an opinion leader. They often ask me about real estate agents I would recommend. I know a lot of people in this community. They are constantly asking me about helping them select a builder. There are several other factors that account for Mr. Green's success in his home buying experiences. He is life cycle, not first cost sensitive. First cost is the price he pays for lots, homes, and construction. Life cycle cost refers to the direct and indirect costs associated with a particular home over time. What about Mr. Blue? He is relatively more first cost sensitive than he is life cycle cost sensitive, but overall, he is less sensitive on both dimensions than is Mr. Green. The IAs often delude themselves when making home buying decisions. They paint a rosy picture of both first and life cycle costs. It's the variation in life cycle costs that shows the most contrast between BA and IA groups. For example, take the various costs associated with selecting a neighborhood that has excellent public schools. Mr. Green always picks one of those, but not Mr. Blue. Before he moved into his new neighborhood, he didn't research the school situation. When he realized the public schools were subpar at best, private school tuition shock set in. Mr. Blue discovered that his children wouldn't be able to gain admission to quality colleges given the preparation they were receiving in the public schools. Add private school tuition of $33,000 per year onto the other life cycle costs associated with getting a real deal on a building lot. It isn't true that all millionaires are oriented toward private school and are averse to public school education for their children. Not really. The majority indicate that the quality of public schools was a significant factor in making a neighborhood decision. Nearly 8 in 10, 79%, stated that an important decision criteria underlying their home selection process was seeking a neighborhood that has excellent public schools. It isn't difficult to appreciate the relationship between wealth, home values, and the quality of public schools. Just consider for a moment how much it costs to send 3 children to a private school. The typical millionaire has 3 children. Why would he want to live in a school district that necessitated the patronage of private schools? He doesn't. He even prefers paying high first-cost prices for homes located in neighborhoods that have quality public schools. The additional evidence is that only 26% of the millionaires surveyed searched for neighborhoods with reasonable property taxes. Most of the BAs, like Mr. Green, realize the trade-offs between paying higher property taxes and having quality public schools. Not once in his life did Mr. Green even consider moving into a neighborhood because it had so-called reasonable school tax rates. In his mind, low tax rates equate with low-quality public schools. Most people in America would never pay $1.7 million for a 5-bedroom home. Even if they could pay for it, most would build elsewhere. It's clear that Mr. Green could have purchased a 5-bedroom home of similar design and space for much less money, if only he and his wife were willing to live in some other town in the tri-state area. But they were wise to stay in Greenwich. They could have purchased a 5-bedroom home for less than one-half of $1.7 million. But it wouldn't have been in the same or similar quality neighborhood. Mr. Green refused to compromise. He never viewed his decision to invest $1.7 million in a home as a risk. To him, a risk would be buying a home for $700,000 in a neighborhood with less potential than the one he chose. Mr. Green's investment of $1.7 million has more than doubled in just under 6 years, because he owns a trophy home in a trophy neighborhood. The area and the home are very desirable to an increasing number of affluent home buyers. Risk has another face as far as Mr. Green is concerned. Finding and purchasing a home in a non-trophy neighborhood is relatively easy, but the real risk is in the difficulty of selling it, especially in situations where the public schools are subpar. So if Mr. Green had paid only one half of the $1.7 million, 5 years later that investment might have appreciated only in a nominal sense. Public schools have a lot to do with the real return on investment. Why are people like Mr. Green better able to make wise decisions about homes than the Mr. Blues of America? Mr. Blue has narrow vision, and he is an investment sales zealot. He sells investments in the stock market, and that's how he earns a high income. He is totally engrossed in this form of telephone dogfighting, and as a result, he neglects other opportunities to generate both realized and unrealized income. Mr. Blue is not alone. One of the factors underlying the behavior of IAs is that they tend to be workaholics. Work consumes them. One might assume that these high-income-producing types adopt the work-hard-play-hard lifestyle, but in general, they are involved in significantly fewer social, religious, civic, and recreational activities than the BAs. They tend to work more and play less. And they are least likely of all the high-income groups to indicate that they love their jobs. Note that many BAs work long hours and work hard, but they are not workaholics who don't enjoy their work. There's nothing so exhausting as working on a job you don't like. The IAs earn big and spend big, and they are unlikely to take defensive actions to reduce the cost of operating their households, because in their minds, such actions are not worth the effort. Reducing operating costs and shopping for homes the way Mr. Green does is also viewed as work, work that in their view pays much less overall than does their main vocation. In some situations, they have a valid argument. You may never get rich using discount coupons to buy groceries, but such activities taken together have a significant influence on one's balance sheet. The IAs don't have a valid argument when it comes to purchasing homes. It's very clear from this national survey of BAs that a home can be more than a man's castle. For them, it can be and is a good investment. If a buyer doesn't plan and doesn't study the opportunities that are available, a home can be a poor investment. Many IA couples have discovered that when it comes to the home buying process, haste does make waste. That's even more apparent when they try to sell the home they hastily purchased years ago. The Hunter's Nose. Early in the 1980s, interest rates were at an all-time high. Even money market funds were paying at or near 20%. People were out of the stock market because they were receiving guaranteed returns on cash and equivalents that were unparalleled. What about the residential real estate market? With mortgage rates near or at, in some areas, 20%, people were not in the mood for buying, which had a dampening effect on real estate prices. Sellers were begging to unload their homes, but they often sat unsold and unoccupied for months, even years. At this same time, the Stanleys wanted to buy a home closer to downtown. My commute was nearly 30 miles one way, and the worst part was the bottleneck at a two-lane bridge. It seemed that all my neighbors and I sat bumper to bumper each workday at the same ridiculous bridge approach. While sitting there, I thought, if I could live on the other side of this river, I'd save an hour each day. But I always countered with, it's stupid even to consider selling a home and buying another when interest rates are so high. This give and take went on for months and months. But the argument ended after I interviewed 10 multimillionaires. The results from this focus group made a major impression on me about real estate. As part of my introduction, I mentioned that I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. In turn, they introduced themselves, all lived and worked in the New York metropolitan area, and all were business owners and first-generation affluent. Oddly, I noticed that one respondent referred to Atlanta as the land of opportunity. Others repeated out loud, Atlanta. Atlanta. During the halftime break and following the conclusion of the interviews, several respondents approached me with Georgia on their minds. They asked if I was currently buying real estate in Atlanta. They also commented about the great prospects for real estate there. This made no sense to me at all. First, none of these multimillionaire respondents were real estate professionals. On their bio cards, they mentioned other industries, printing, office supplies, appraising, manufacturing, and so on. Second, I was confused about their enthusiasm for investing in real estate. It seemed foolhardy given the current interest rates. Why were these people interested in the real estate market, and why in Atlanta? I told them that I wasn't interested in buying real estate because of the high interest rates and general doldrums in the market. Yes, even wonderful Atlanta was suffering from high interest rates. One of the respondents said something that made a major, lasting impression upon me. "Tom, this is the best time to buy." "But the interest rates are so high. Who is buying?" "Smart people. They don't always need to borrow. Have you considered buying?" "Yes, many times. Actually, we are thinking of building a home. But it's the old interest rate problem." "Do you have enough cash to buy a building lot in a quality area?" "Yes. Then do it. Do it now. Never follow the crowd. I'll wager there's plenty of property for sale. Look in the classifieds. Call a few banks that have foreclosures." The day after this lesson, I started searching for a lot. Mr. Brown was right. There were quite a few lots for sale in the classifieds. In short order, I purchased one, but I did consider a variety of offerings, and I had a chance to visit several sellers. The lot I selected was 1 acre, on what was once a plantation. The price for this prime lot was $29,500. Just 2 years before, a lot of this type had sold for double this price. During the next upswing in real estate, some comparable lots sold for $100,000. Who was selling at the time I was buying? Several builders were suffering under bad economic conditions but still had bills and debts to pay. Some of them had homes, lovely homes, just sitting and sitting. Many owned lots as well. Yet there were few buyers, in spite of the fact that these homes and lots were priced well below builders' cost. There was another interesting group of sellers who fit the definition of income statement affluent. Each had purchased lots not as investments, but as places to build their dream homes during periods when economic-driven euphoria had infected Atlanta. They'd paid premium prices in a seller's market. The economy was producing an abnormally large number of high-income or high-commission-generating stockbrokers, life insurance sales professionals, new business development officers in engineering and contracting, and healthcare professionals. Most of these people made such purchases via credit while simultaneously expanding their inventory of consumer goods and loans. They bought and borrowed as if happy times were going to exist forever. They were buying in a seller's market. What about the balance sheet affluent? At the same time, they were selling their lots. When the market turned the other way, the balance sheet affluent were buying once again. Some held on to their building lots for years, through several ups and downs in the economy. Then, just at the peak of real estate prices, they placed their homes for sale. Many built homes on the lots purchased at bargain prices. Some bartered their lots and purchased homes held by builders. Others found best buys in the residential areas that they routinely monitored. Some deliberately waited for the bottom of the market to have builders construct homes, at a time when builders were more than delighted to build at or near cost just for the work. That's why New York City-based millionaires in the focus group were interested in real estate, and particularly real estate in Atlanta. Several in the group indicated having children or grandchildren who attended Emory University or Georgia Institute of Technology. Visits with these students gave them a chance to look over the Atlanta market. Another hallmark of the affluent is productivity. In essence, they killed two birds with one stone, proving again that another hallmark of the millionaire mind is productivity. Real estate as part of one's portfolio. There is something else about the balance sheet affluent. They do not place all their investment eggs in one single vulnerable basket. It's a major myth about the affluent that they have all their money in their own businesses. Not by a long shot. Nor do most millionaires completely rely on the stock market, the real estate market, the fruit and vegetable markets, or the appliance market. Most are well diversified and most have some type of investment real estate. Even many of those millionaires who have a strong affinity for common stocks hold some real estate holdings. There is a strong correlation between net worth and the proportion of one's wealth that is invested in real estate. I learned this early in my career. I was hired by a large investment organization to conduct a study of the investment habits of multimillionaires. When I asked the focus group about investment habits, most had a chunk of their wealth in conventional financial investment categories, but they had much, much more than stocks and bonds. Most were astute private investors. The business owners owned some industrial real estate. Others owned their own office complex, factory, medical science complex, rental property, vacation rental property, shopping centers, and so on. Several of the respondents occasionally invested in single-family homes, and one of these respondents, Alvin, had a hunter's nose. He was a high school dropout who owned a distribution business worth over $30 million. He lived in a fine neighborhood just outside New York City. He made it very clear that his home was purchased after he became a multimillionaire during a buyer's market. The home had appreciated almost threefold in about 15 years. Alvin took more credit for some of his other home-related investments. He noticed that in his own fine neighborhood, pockets of economic opportunity often existed. His first target was a home near his own that had been unoccupied for almost a year because of a divorce. During this time, the home had been neglected. Finally, it was put up for sale, but the real estate market was weak for prospective sellers. Alvin eventually purchased the home at a bargain. He then had it cleaned, painted, and generally improved. He rented it for several years to a relative, then the tide turned in the market. Buyers began to outnumber sellers, so he put the home up for sale at 20% over the appraisal price. Alvin is balance sheet affluent, and BAs sell to earn a profit, not because they are in dire need. He didn't need the money, and he knew the market was rising, so he priced his property with that in mind. In the rising market, the value of the home increased each day. All that he needed was one buyer who wanted to pay top dollar for a home in Trophyville. Alvin sold the property for near his asking price and grossed over 50% on his investment. He made more than he would have at the time if he'd invested in the stock market. Doing what Alvin did is not for most people. Remember that he owned his own company and had a large maintenance and clerical staff that he paid to moonlight on his real estate venture. And Alvin was not starting at ground zero on the learning curve. He told me that if he was at or near ground zero, he would never have contemplated buying investment homes. If you are not in a similar position, you may wish to think twice about following Alvin's lead. But even those without his staff and experience find it productive to buy homes for their personal use in a neighborhood with which they are familiar. A growing number of millionaires in the BA category are doing what Alvin has done, pricing their own homes in Trophyville and waiting to get the price they name. They sell in sellers' markets, buy in buyers' markets. They often buy bargains in their own or adjacent neighborhoods. Some take residence in these bargain-priced trophies. Others use them purely as investment vehicles. Home game, away game. A growing number of BAs are becoming area-specific experts. When they see an opportunity to enhance their net worth in a certain neighborhood they know well, they take it. Today, it's not unusual to find an affluent household that has traded up or traded down to another home several times. More and more, it's within the same or adjacent residential community. When these BAs discover a bargain-priced home in their area of expertise, they pounce on it. Many times, a home soon to be on the market was discovered not in the classifieds, but during a conversation at a bridge party or a chance discussion at a PTA meeting. I call this the home game, as in home team. The home team has the advantage of playing on its own field with the home crowd. Alvin's case relates well to this concept. He has the home field advantage over many prospective buyers who don't know nearly as much about the neighborhood, and they may be on a quick 2-day house shopping visit related to an employment change. Think twice about ever considering the purchase of an expensive home over the weekend. If you have no alternative, at the very least, hire the top real estate agent in the area to assist you. Often it's these types, including a few other non-self-employed workers, who are placed in away game situations. Winning the away games. You don't need the home field advantage if you play the game the way Mr. Dye does. Mr. Dye is an employee who has worked for two major corporations during his much-traveled career. During each of his last six long-distance residential moves, he and his wife have made a considerable profit each and every time. No matter that he was in Chicago for several years, then in Houston for several more, and then was transferred to Orlando, Mr. and Mrs. Dye always made money each time they moved. They bought low and sold high. How did a member of the away team bat 6 for 6 while playing away games? Each time, Mr. and Mrs. Dye transformed themselves into members of the home team, as they did again in their most recent home purchase and sale. Mr. Dye told me that he never puts himself in the position of having to buy or sell homes in a panic. Like most BAs, he and his wife are very patient. They have a plan and a set of goals to follow. When Mr. Dye was told by his Fortune 50 corporate employer of yet another reassignment, another relocation, he and his wife were well prepared. They didn't allow the euphoria of a new assignment and a move to an exciting town translate into a bad decision. In this most recent venture, the couple took 6 months to sell their old home and make a purchase decision. Mr. Dye's employer was very fair, even generous. He reported that his corporate employers had offered to buy each of the 6 homes he needed to sell, each time at a good, fair market price. But Mr. Dye turned down each offer, and he was wise to do so. Each time the couple sold their homes, they made at least 15% more than the fair market value. Fair market value is often computed by analogy. Appraisers rely on the prices that homes in a particular area have recently sold for, given certain size and style parameters. Mr. and Mrs. Dye were able to outsmart the experts, the seasoned appraisers, and generate top dollars for each home they sold. They strongly believe that cleanliness is next to godliness. Their homes were always spotless inside and out. The Dyes don't just spruce up their home today in anticipation of selling it tomorrow. It's always in turnkey condition. And they are extremely demanding about the homes they purchase. They only buy those that are in excellent condition. Then they go a step or two beyond excellence. Interior and exterior color and decor are always up to date. They only buy homes they feel they can sell later at a profit. Who would be most likely to purchase a home in above excellent condition but at a minimum premium of 20% above market? What buyer would place a premium on being able to move into a turnkey home immediately? In the most recent case, Mr. and Mrs. Dye sold their home to a two-career couple employed in the computer industry. The couple moved frequently. Both were in their late 30s and both had very demanding, high-paying jobs that involved a great deal of travel. Neither had any interest in restoring or even redecorating a home, nor were they interested in purchasing a new home out of a builder's existing inventory or building a home on a custom basis. They correctly assumed that new homes need new lawns, new decorating, new drapes, and other materials. This couple was all about work, aggressively pursuing a career and earning big incomes. To them, time and effort spent outside their vocations translated into big negatives. They wanted a home they could immediately occupy, and they were very sensitive to variations in the conditions of homes they considered. But they were significantly less sensitive to the variations in price among homes that competed for their dollars. Also, the couple allocated one weekend to find a suitable home, and they knew nothing of the real estate market in the city where they were reassigned. In essence, they were yet another IA couple playing yet another away game. This couple paid the largest percent premium over market value in the history of the subdivision, nearly 33%. 17 months later, the same couple sold the same home for only 85% of what they'd paid. But at that time, the home was not in above excellent condition, and the couple was in a hurry to sell. Their employers subsidized part of their loss. Always have a plan in place before you or your employer decide that it's time to change addresses. Part of this plan is to keep your home in excellent condition, but you should also keep in touch with top real estate agents in your area. Contact them every 6 months or so. Periodically note the names of the superstars in residential real estate and rely on this list completely. Ask business associates for referrals and canvas real estate firms for the names of the top guns. When you interview them, ask about market conditions and don't be shy about asking about recent productivity. In particular, ask how many of their recent sales have come from clients moving into the area. ask about the average amount of time these clients allocated to searching before actually purchasing a home. Often, the very best agents have close working relationships with top firms in major industries in your area. If you are in San Francisco, for example, you may wish to consider an agent who services corporations in the computer and high technology industries. When a major company is hiring an important employee from out of state, the firm wants the transition to go smoothly. Part of the process is to ask a top-notch real estate agent to assist, so your plan should include familiarizing yourself with agents who have excellent track records in making these companies and their inbound executives happy. Give strong consideration to hiring one of them to list your home. I have found that many of these top-producing agents work especially hard to sell homes that they also list. I take no pleasure in saying that it's often a bad mistake to hire a neighbor, friend, or even a relative as a real estate agent. Business is business, and today more than ever before you can ill afford to be represented by someone other than a highly productive and completely professional real estate expert. In my mind, there is a very clear distinction between three types of real estate agents. First, there are what I refer to as listers, then there are sellers. And finally, there are those extraordinary sales and marketing commandos who are great at both acquiring listings and selling what they and other agents list. Ask yourself which type you want. There are some exceptional listers and sellers. Some very aggressive listers have built up tremendous goodwill with other brokers, so that other brokers take special note when their name is on a for sale sign. But most agents are not sales and marketing commandos by any stretch of the imagination. From their perspective, it's much easier to encourage a neighbor, friend, or relative to list with me, me, me. It's much more difficult to sell because most sales are made to strangers. But in my mind, the very, very best real estate agents both list and sell. I will always recommend Connie Glenn. Not everyone can sell real estate. Only a small number of real estate sales professionals achieve ESP, what I call extraordinary sales professional status, and maintain that status during downturns in the real estate market. Connie Glenn is one of them. I was once in the unenviable position of having to sell a house when the mortgage rate was near 20%. What there was of a real estate market in Atlanta at that time was a buyer's market. Like millions of other homeowners, I made the mistake of asking the first person who came to mind, a friend, neighbor, and part-time real estate agent, to sell the property. This was the easy thing to do. After more than 2 months, the only results were no offers, no nibbles, and very little traffic. It became apparent that a change had to be made. I called the manager of the largest real estate agency in Atlanta. "I want the name of your very, very best agent. No, not the best in Dunwoody or Rosswell. I want the best horse in your stable." Connie and her assistant appeared at my home soon after I called her. She agreed to accept my case. Traffic increased overnight. Within a month, the house sold for 95% of the asking price. I was amazed at her success. Not only was the market difficult, but the home was cedar. Cedar is not my first choice for siding in Georgia. It discolors and mildews. Periodic cleaning is necessary. Who would pay 95% of the asking price? Connie found an executive from the lumber industry who loved cedar. After all, Tom, what would you expect a lumber expert to live in? A brick colonial? It would be bad for his reputation and the image of the lumber company. My experience with Connie taught me something about marketing. If you want to avoid losing money on your real estate dealings, call an ESP. Note that Ms. Glenn both listed and sold our property. Her manager told me that Connie established her reputation as a top gun by aggressively seeking listings of homes that others were unable to sell. In her mind, every home had a potential buyer. The key was to find that buyer. Connie always had the ability to do so. What Connie Glenn does to establish herself as an ESP is so simple that most people can't see it. Brilliance in sales and marketing is often indicated in the simplest, most practical ways and ultimately in the results. Connie recognized that every real estate market has a particular set of characteristics. These characteristics have significant bearing on home purchasing behavior. Georgia is a top five state in the production of lumber. It's a state with vast tracts of forests. Many firms involved in lumber directly or indirectly have a presence in Georgia. These range in size from the Georgia Pacific Corporation to the smallest forest farm. It's wood and wood people, no matter what else you call it. Knowing that Georgia is a wood state tells you that many inbound movers are employed or will be employed by wood companies. Connie understood this, and she developed contacts and a great reputation in wood and several other key industries. She has the so-called hunter's nose, and she has the determination of a bulldog. If you move several times during your career, and if you hire a Connie Glenn type each time, you will likely net much more money from her expertise at selling. It's not unusual that after 5 or 6 moves, you will net more than the full purchase price of your first home. The Connie types can and do account for hundreds of thousands of dollars in your pocket. In some cases, even millions over a millionaire's life cycle. Plan or panic? As part of your plan to sell or buy a home, decide your time parameters. Don't panic when you find that you'll be moving to a different geographical area. Anticipate that if you are an employee, your employer could ask you to move someday. So decide beforehand how long you'll be willing to search for a home. The Dyes were quite willing to wait up to 6 months to find a home, and of course to sell the home they currently owned, but that's not for everyone. Mr. Dye's employer was generous and paid all of the Dyes' moving expenses, including the rent incurred while the couple searched for a home. If your employer is not so liberal, you may still find it worthwhile to rent, so you have the time to transform yourself from a member of the visiting team to one of the home team. A few months' rent is not a lot to pay to acquire a home that will appreciate and eventually be easy to resell. No such thing as a perfect prediction. It's amazing to me that some people spend more time shopping for automobiles than for the homes they purchase. As the saying goes, a fool and his money soon are parted. Before you even give consideration to purchasing a home, take time to study the clues. Ask why the owner is selling. He may not tell you that it's because his neighbor's home is becoming an eyesore. It is very easy to overlook the condition of the homes that surround the one you are interested in. Often people speed past these other homes. Slow down, walk the neighborhood, and closely examine the other homes. What percentage need exterior work? How many need new gutters? How well are the lawns and shrubs kept? Who are your prospective neighbors? What do they do for a living? Ask your real estate agent about the trends in the neighborhood. Are the values of the homes on the rise, or are they flat or even in decline? Ask such questions and you will benefit. Your agent will be impressed with your sensitivity and may be more candid with answers. As you walk the neighborhood, knock on doors. Talk to people who may be your neighbors and look them over carefully. Ask about the schools in the area. Ask what they enjoy or dislike about the neighborhood. These questions can help you make an educated purchase decision. What if the values of homes in a neighborhood are not keeping pace with those in nearby neighborhoods? What if 1 in 5 homes need exterior paint? What if the homeowner next door has recently lost his job as a corporate middle manager? What if his home needs exterior work? Give serious consideration to buying elsewhere. Many neighborhoods decline in real dollar value terms. That happens even in affluent areas. Often it is impossible to predict whether a particular neighborhood will decline or appreciate in value, and this is especially true in brand new or near new subdivisions. In this regard, I have a simple rule. Look carefully at the homes in a well-established neighborhood. If more than 1 in 5 clearly needs painting or landscaping, you may wish to avoid the risk of buying there. Build or buy? On the day I began writing this section, my friend John stopped by to ask my advice about whether to buy or build a home for his family. I told John he was lucky. The numbers were fresh in my mind. What do millionaires do regarding the build versus buy issue? Only about 1 in 4 millionaires ever had a home built for them. This includes all categories, primary homes, second homes, summer homes, winter homes, and so on. The proportion of millionaires who build instead of buying increases with the level of net worth. However, only 35% of the decamillionaires ever had a home built for them. John seemed a bit shocked by these revelations, but I had anticipated his response. It seems that John wants to build because he thinks he can save money that way. And he thought most millionaires built as opposed to buying existing homes. After I gave him my data, he came up with a brand new thesis. Now I got it. Millionaires don't need to save money building. But I'm not rich. That's why I want to build. The I'll save money myth. Why is it that the large majority of millionaires never build homes? They believe that there are some benefits of building versus buying, but they also feel that those benefits don't offset the marginal costs of their time, energy, and other important resources. This fact differs from conventional opinions. It's a popular belief that wealthy people have the need for custom products. Don't millionaires have such enormous egos they want things designed specifically for them? Make no mistake about it, there are some who express themselves this way. To these people, there is no substitute for a custom-designed and built home. Their home is not just a home, it's an extension of who they are and what they wish to tell people about themselves. A resale, no matter how nice, just will not satisfy their needs. This is a small segment of the millionaire population. Fewer than 1 in 10 fall into this category. A very small segment, fewer than 15 in 100 millionaires, decide to build their primary residence because they believe they can save money this way. In reality, these millionaires are very sensitive to variations in the cost differences of building a home versus buying one. Some act as if they put a lower premium on the value of their time. They believe that it's financially beneficial to spend more time on the process of building than working at their primary vocation. This group includes the most price-sensitive bargain shoppers of all the millionaires. They build because they think they are going to save a lot of money doing so. They may look at an existing home priced at $400,000 and say to themselves, I could have built it for $300,000, including the lot. What if you are a young attorney in a position that has great prospects for advancement? If you make partner, your income will jump from $78,000 per year to over $300,000. Should you take time to have a home built for you? Are you up for taking hundreds of phone calls from your builder, suppliers, and subcontractors at your office during a 6 to 10 month period? Do you think it valuable to visit your construction site every few days to make sure it's done right? Just envision that two young attorneys are competing for one opening as partner. Who would you bet on, Mr. Build or Mr. Buy? Even if Mr. Build saved $100,000 off a comparable home, he spent so much time and energy on the project that it took the edge off his performance as an attorney. He did not make partner. Good legal advice. There is a very wide variation among occupational groups in regard to building versus buying a home. Millionaires in some occupational categories are significantly more likely to build as opposed to buying an existing home. As a rule, wealthy attorneys are averse to building. Nearly 9 in 10 attorneys, 88%, have never had any type of home built for them. Millionaires in the senior corporate executive occupational category, 32%, and those who are business owners or entrepreneurs, 31%, are somewhat more likely to build homes than the average, 27%, for all millionaires. There is a relationship between one's level of wealth and the propensity to build a home. About 1 in 4, 24%, of the millionaires in the $1 million to $2 million net worth category indicate having built homes. Conversely, about 35% of decamillionaires have built homes. Wealthy attorneys are unlikely to have homes built specifically for them for two reasons. First, they are extremely productive. Fully 80% earn incomes in excess of $200,000 annually, and about one-half earn incomes of more than $400,000. Consider the time and effort it takes to generate such incomes in the light of one fact. Legal services cannot be inventoried. They have to be rendered constantly. Many respondents from the legal profession said that they and their colleagues have no time to get involved with home construction. Attorneys are good judges of the value of their time, and having a home built is a time-consuming event. The second reason is that attorneys understand the legal and corresponding economic risks involved in hiring a home builder. You can hire the best, most honest builder in your state and still have problems. If he is disabled or passes away just after your home is framed, or just after you paid him a small fortune to get the project started, who will now build your home? What is the disposition of the money you advanced your builder? Here are some other problems that millionaires have shared with me about their recent building experiences. My builder hired a sub to install the wallpaper in our 18-foot foyer. Afterward, the sub called and asked my wife if she was pleased with the wallpapering. She reported that everything was fine except one detail. The wallpaper was installed upside down. As a result, our builder never paid the sub, but he put a lien on our home. This in turn prevented us from having our permanent mortgage approved. We had to hire a lawyer and purchase a bond. It all took more time than money. All the wallpaper had to be removed and new paper installed. Our builder was not a lot of help. Built on a steep hill, great view, contractor poured the basement slab just following torrential rains. The whole thing, slab of wet concrete, broke loose. Concrete all rushed down the hill. Contractor said it was my fault for insisting on having a full basement. My lawyer persuaded him to see it our way. Our builder assured us that there were no rocks underground on the lot. First day of groundbreaking, he called and asked, "Could you go with a slab? No basement?" We hit granite just below the surface. After more than 200 sticks of explosives and more than a week of blasting and removing, we were in the financial hole. So much for cost plus pricing. Cost more than $10,000 just to truck the rock away. Worker knocked a hole in our foundation for pipes, then filled in around pipes with the wrong type of mortar. Cracked our 9-foot foundation, top to bottom. It's still cracked. It still leaks when it rains. I've called my attorney. Subcontractor framer overbilled our builder. He passed the problem on to us. When we questioned him, he just got angry. The builder said that the framing would be Wednesday. We thought he meant Wednesday of next week, not 2 months from now. The builder told us that our fireplace would be finished as soon as his rock mason came back to work. Our builder was his own rock mason. Carpet installers stapled through the floor sensors for our alarm system. Got to know a lot of police people just after moving into our new home. Contractor hired a rookie with a bulldozer to complete the grading, leveled every single tree in our 100-foot by 200-foot backyard. It was once filled with a variety of hardwoods. At completion, we had receipts from 360 suppliers. We probably spoke to at least half of them during the project. I have a stack of complaints from my clients about their builders. These are very expensive homes and very angry people. So, if you are interested in having your dream home built for you, consider what I've learned from millionaires. Consult your attorney, and if possible, ask him to help you find a builder. If your attorney is a partner in a large firm, you have some advantage. Out of 50 or 100 lawyers, you are likely to find at least 5 or 10 who had homes built for them, and a few may have been completely satisfied with their builders. Or at least they may have clients who hired high-grade builders. Allow your attorney to relate to you all the legal issues involved in building your own home. Never even consider signing a construction contract without the input of your attorney. Even better, ask him to write the contract, then let him work out the details with your builder. Don't go out of control regarding your need to express yourself in the home you build. If you insist that every single element in your dream home be unique and custom designed, prepare yourself for delays, disappointments, and cost overruns. In terms of time and money, it's more productive to avoid the fully customized dwelling. More than the purchase price. He telephoned my office one morning, a parent with an unusual question. Mr. Adam, as I referred to him, had a net worth of about $20 million. He seemed puzzled by my response. He thought I would just say, "What a great idea." He asked, "Should I buy my 30-year-old son, Nate, a $425,000 home?" I told Mr. Adam that I would first have to ask him a few questions, then I'd give him some data. With the data, I assumed he would make up his own mind. "Do you think that your son can afford it?" "Perhaps I'm not making myself clear. I am going to buy the home for my son, outright." "I understand that. I'm not talking about the purchase price. I'm talking about the costs associated with operating a $425,000 home and the lifestyle associated with such a home." I explained to Mr. Adam that $425,000 was like the initiation fee at a country club. The monthly fees are another issue. Mr. Adam didn't seem to get the point that I was making. He believed that Nate, his son would have few financial burdens. After all, Nate would have no mortgage payments, and he'd have the title to a home valued at $425,000. What could be simpler? I began to think that Mr. Adam had already made up his mind. He seemed inclined to purchase the home for Nate. After all, $425,000 was only about 2% of Mr. Adams' net worth. But there is a problem with his logic. In many ways, it's irrelevant how much or how little of his wealth is involved, for it's Nate and his family who will be living in the home. I asked, "How much does your son earn annually?" "About $30,000. "What does he do for a living?" "He recently started a new career in the insurance and investment business." "What about his wife? Does she work?" "She is a part-time hairstylist, but she wants to quit and be a housewife full-time." "So are you saying that the couple has a combined earned income of a bit over $40,000? "That is pretty close to the average for all households in America." Nate and his wife may be just average in terms of their combined earned income, but they would be extraordinary if they lived in a neighborhood filled with $425,000 homes. I was well aware of the demographic characteristics of the neighborhoods where Nate and his wife had been home shopping. The typical household there had an annual earned income of more than three times the couple's. "Do you think your son and his wife will fit in living at Legacy Estates? I have to tell you that many of the households in that area are in the six digits of annual earned income. Most of the earners there are executives, professionals, or successful business owners." My daughter-in-law instigated this. She likes the area in the North County. It has a tennis and golf club as part of the development. She wants to be a full-time housewife and play tennis.